Side 8, The Mark of the Assassin, by Daniel Silva. Continuing on page 376. I laid down only one ground rule. She wasn't allowed to photocopy the files. I stayed at her house all night while she worked. Then I went into the office early and put the files back in their original place. Nothing to it, really. You still have the key? Elizabeth asked. Yeah. I thought about throwing it off Memorial Bridge, but I kept it instead. Good. Why? Because we're going to go in there tonight to get those files again. Chapter 42, Washington, D.C. Officially, there was a lid in place at the White House, which meant the press office expected no more news that day, and the President and First Lady had no public events and no plans to leave the residence. But at 8 p.m., a single black sedan slipped from the south gate of the White House and entered the evening traffic of downtown Washington. Ann Beckwith sat alone in the back seat. There was no bomb-proof presidential limousine, no black Chevy Suburban chase vehicles, no police escort, just a White House driver and a single Secret Service agent seated in the front seat. For years, Ann had been escaping the White House in this manner at least once a week. She enjoyed getting out into the real world, as she liked to put it. For Anne, the real world was not far removed from the opulence of the executive mansion. Usually, she took a short ride to the wealthy enclaves of Georgetown or Colorama or Spring Valley for drinks and dinner with old friends or important political allies. The car headed north up Connecticut Avenue, then turned west onto Massachusetts after navigating the heavy traffic of DuPont Circle. A moment later, it turned onto California Street and slowed outside the large brick mansion. The garage door opened, and the black sedan slipped silently inside. The Secret Service agent waited for the garage door to close again before getting out of the car. He walked around the back and opened the First Lady's door. Her host was waiting when she stepped out of the car. She kissed his cheek and said, "Hello, Mitchell. So good to see you." Ann Beckwith did not come for an evening of pleasant conversation and good food. This was business. She accepted a glass of wine, but ignored the plate of cheese and pâté one of Elliot's drones placed on the coffee table between them. "I want to know if the situation is under control," she said coldly. "And if it's not under control, I want to know just what in the hell you're doing to get it under control." If Susanna Dayton had lived to publish that article, it could have been very damaging. Her unfortunate murder bought us some time, but I don't think we're in the clear yet. "Unfortunate murder," Anne repeated, derision in her voice. "Why hasn't the Post published a story?" "Because they're trying to reconfirm all her reporting, and they're not quite there yet." "Are they going to get there?" "Not if I can help it." Ann Beckwith lit a cigarette and exhaled a slender stream of smoke sharply between her tense lips. "What are you doing to prevent it?" "I think it would be unwise for you to know about any of this, Ann." "Don't bullshit me, Mitchell. Just tell me what I want to know." "We think Susanna Dayton's best friend is working with the Post now. A lawyer named Elizabeth Osborne."
"Isn't she Douglas Cannon's girl?"
"Yes, she is.
Cannon hates Jim. They were on armed services together. Cannon was the chairman, and Jim was a ranking Republican. They were barely on speaking terms at the end of it."
Ann finished her wine.
"Aren't you going to offer me another glass? California, isn't it?
God, we make wonderful wine." Elliot poured more wine. Ann said, "Mitchell, we go way back. Jim and I owe you a great deal. You've been very generous over the years. But I will not let Jim be tarnished by this in any way. He's run his last campaign. He has nothing to lose now except his place in the history books."
"I understand that."
"I don't think you do. If this becomes public in a bad way, I will use every ounce of power and influence I possess to make sure you're the one who takes the fall. I won't let Jim be hurt. And I don't give a damn about you at this point. Do I make myself clear? Elliot poured down the rest of his scotch. He didn't appreciate being lectured by Ann Beckwith. If it hadn't been for Ann's greed and Ann's insecurities, Elliot would never have been able to establish his special financial relationship with her husband. Ann always called the shots, even when it came to graft. He stared at her coldly for a moment, then nodded and said, "Yes, Ann, you've made yourself quite clear. If this thing blows up, Jim will survive it. But your little missile project will go down the crapper. It won't be built, or they'll award the contract to a less controversial company. You'll be finished." "I know the stakes." "Good." She stood up and collected her coat. Mitchell Elliott remained seated. "I just have one question for you, Mitchell. Did the same people who killed the reporter shoot down the airliner?" Elliot looked at her, astonishment on his face. "What the hell are you talking about?" "Answering a question with a question. That's a bad sign."
"Good night, darling."
"Oh, and don't bother to get up. I'm only the first lady. I'll see myself out." Elizabeth dressed the part of a busy Washington lawyer returning to the office for some late-night work. Jeans, urban cowboy boots, a comfortable beige cotton sweater. Max Lewis lived near DuPont Circle, and his daily work attire reflected the trends of his neighborhood. Black jeans, black suede loafers, black turtleneck shirt, dark gray jacket. The law offices of Braxton, Allworth, and Kettleman stood on the corner of Connecticut Avenue and K Street. Michael waited in the car. Elizabeth and Max walked into the lobby together, checked in with a security guard, and took the elevator up to the 11th floor. Elizabeth's office was on the north end of the floor, overlooking Connecticut Avenue. Samuel Braxton had the largest office in the firm, a series of rooms along the corner of Connecticut Avenue and K Street, with a magnificent view of the White House and the Washington Monument. Elizabeth unlocked her office, switched on the lights, and went inside. She spoke to Max in a loud, clear voice. She wanted everything to appear normal. Max loaded some extra paper in the copier and made a pot of coffee. Elizabeth could hear the distant drone of vacuum cleaners from somewhere on the floor. She took the keys and walked down the length of the hall to Braxton's office. She knocked once gently, received no answer, and unlocked the door with a duplicate key. She stepped inside and quickly closed the door. She took a small flashlight from her handbag and switched it on. Elizabeth was in the exterior office where Braxton's two secretaries worked. The file room was at the far end of the office through a heavy door. Elizabeth switched keys and opened the door. She closed it behind her and switched on the light. Max had told her where to find the Elliott and Beckwith files. On the far wall, top left. The top shelf was beyond her reach. Braxton's secretaries kept a library-style step stool inside the room for just such occasions. She carried the stool across the room, stepped up on it, and began picking her way through the files. She went through the entire row once and found nothing. She started from the beginning, forcing herself to go slowly, but once again found nothing. She tried the shelf below, but it was the same thing. Nothing. She swore softly beneath her breath. Braxton had removed the files. Elizabeth climbed down off the stool and moved across the room toward the door. She heard sounds in the office outside the door, a key being shoved in a lock, the click of a light switch, the scrape of a metal cart. Then she heard the crunch of a key shoved forcefully into the door lock a few feet from her. The lock gave way, and the door pushed back. Elizabeth carefully examined the man standing before her and realized immediately something was wrong. Most of the cleaning staff were small, dark-skinned Central Americans of Indian origin who spoke almost no English. This man was tall, about 6 feet, and fair-skinned. His dark hair obviously had been cut and styled by an expensive professional. His coverall was new and unsoiled, his fingernails clean. But it was the ring on his left hand that caught Elizabeth's attention. It bore the insignia of the Army Special Forces, the Green Berets. "Can I help you?" Elizabeth said. She thought it was best to take the offensive. "I heard the noise," the man said in thickly accented English. Elizabeth knew he was lying, because she had been very careful not to make any sound. "Why didn't you call security?" she shot back. The man shrugged and said, "I thought I'd check it out myself first." "You know, catch a thief, be a big hero, get the reward or something." She made a show of looking at the name tag on his coverall. "Are you an American, Carlos?" He shook his head. "I am from Ecuador." "Where did you get that ring?" "Pawn shop in Adams Morgan. Muy bonito, don't you think?" "It's lovely, Carlos. Now, if you'll excuse me." She walked past him and entered the exterior office. "Find what you're looking for," he said to her back. "Actually, I was just putting something back." "Okay. Good night, Signora." Maybe he was telling the truth, Michael said. Maybe he really is Carlos from Ecuador, and he got the ring at a pawn shop in Adams Morgan. "Bullshit," Elizabeth said. Max had taken them to a restaurant in DuPont Circle called the Child Harold. It was popular with journalists and young congressional staff. They sat at a corner table in the cellar bar. Elizabeth desperately wanted a cigarette, but chewed her nails instead. "I've never seen him before," Max said. "But that doesn't mean much. The people in those jobs come and go all the time." "You've never seen him before, Max, because he's not a fucking janitor. And he's not Carlos from fucking Ecuador." "I know what I saw." She looked at Michael. "Remember what you said about that feeling you get when someone's watching you?" "Well, I have that feeling right now." "She's not an idiot," Henry Rodriguez reported over the phone. "She's a big-time lawyer. I tried to talk my way out of it. Did my best Freddie Prinz from Chico and the Man. But I know she made me." "Why the fuck were you wearing the ring?" Callahan said. "I forgot. Shoot me." "Don't give me any ideas." "Where are they now?" "Restaurant called the Child Harold. 20th Street, north of DuPont Circle." "Where are you?" "Payphone on the other side of Connecticut Avenue. I can't get any closer." "Stay put. I'll have someone there in 5 minutes." Callahan hung up and looked at Elliot. "We have another small problem, sir." Chapter 43, Washington, D.C. The following morning, Delaroche sat on a bench in DuPont Circle, watching the crowd of bicycle couriers taking their morning coffee. He found them vaguely amusing, the way they laughed and joked and threw things at each other. But he was not watching them simply to pass the time. He carefully noted the way they dressed, the kinds of satchels they carried, the manner in which they walked. Shortly after 9 o'clock, the couriers began receiving calls over their radios, and each reluctantly mounted a bike and pedaled off to work. Delaroche waited until the last was gone, then flagged down a taxi and gave the driver an address. The taxi took Delaroche along M Street into Georgetown and deposited him at the base of Key Bridge. He entered the shop. A salesman asked if he needed help, and Delaroche shook his head. He started with the clothing. He selected the most flamboyant and colorful jersey and riding breeches he could find. Next, he selected shoes, socks, a helmet, and a backpack. He carried everything to the front of the store and stacked it on the checkout counter. "Anything else?" the salesman asked. Delaroche pointed to the most expensive mountain bike in the store. The attendant lifted it from the display rack and wheeled it toward the service counter. "Where are you taking that?" Delaroche asked quietly, conscious of his accented English. "We need to check out the bike, sir. It's going to take an hour or so." "Just put air in the tires and give it to me." "Suit yourself. Will this be cash or charge, sir?" but Delaroche was already counting out $100 bills. The next hour, Delaroche went shopping along Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown. In a clothing store, he purchased a bandana for his head. In an electronics store, a small battery-powered tape player with headphones. In a jewelry store, he purchased several gaudy gold chains for his neck and had both his ears pierced and hoop earrings inserted. He changed in the gas station toilet. He removed his street clothing and put on the long cycling breeches and winter-weight jersey. He tied the bandana over his head and put the gold chains around his neck. He attached the tape player to the waistband of his breeches and placed the headphones around his neck. He stuffed his street clothes into the backpack along with a silenced Beretta and looked at himself in the mirror. Something was missing. He put on his Ray-Ban sunglasses, the same glasses he had used to kill the man in Paris, and looked at his reflection once more. Now it was right. He stepped outside. A man in a leather jacket was about to steal his bike. "Hey, motherfucker," Delaroche said, mimicking the dialect of the couriers on DuPont Circle. "The last thing you want to do is mess with my ride." "Hey, be cool. I was just checking it out," the man said, backing rapidly away. "Peace and love and all that bullshit." Delaroche climbed on the bicycle and pedaled toward Michael Osborne's home. Delaroche reviewed his plan to kill Osborne one last time as he pedaled along the leafy streets of West Georgetown. Killing him would be difficult. He was a married man with no serious vices. He would not succumb to a sexual advance from Astrid. He was a professional intelligence officer who had spent many years in dangerous situations. Instinctively, he would be personally vigilant at all times. Delaroche considered simply knocking on Osborne's door on the pretense of delivering a package and shooting him when he answered. But there was a chance Osborne would recognize Delaroche. He had been on the Chelsea embankment, after all, and shoot him first. He considered trying to enter Osborne's home by stealth, but surely a large, expensive home in a crime-ridden city like Washington was protected by a security system. He decided he would have to kill him by surprise, somewhere in the open, which is why Delaroche was dressed as a bicycle courier. N Street presented Delaroche with his first serious problem. There were no shops, no cafes, and no telephone booths. No place for Delaroche to kill time inconspicuously. Just large federal-style brick homes set tightly against the sidewalk. Delaroche waited on the corner of 33rd and N Streets, outside a large home with a grand pillared porch, thinking about what to do. He had but one option: ride back and forth along N Street and hope he spotted Osborne entering or leaving the house. This was alien to Delaroche. Whenever possible, he preferred to kill by being in exactly the right place at exactly the right time. But he had no other choice. He mounted the bicycle, pedaled to 35th Street, turned around, and pedaled back to 33rd Street, watching Osborne's house as closely as possible. After 20 minutes of this, a man emerged from the house, dressed in a gray and white tracksuit. Delaroche looked carefully at the face. It was the same face as the photograph in the dossier. It was the same face he had seen that night on the Chelsea embankment. It was Michael Osborne. Osborne bent over and stretched the back of his legs. He leaned against the lamp post and stretched his calf muscles. Delaroche, watching him from two blocks away, could see Osborne's eyes flickering over the street and the parked cars. Finally, Osborne stood and broke into a light run. He turned left on 34th Street, right on M Street, and headed across T Bridge toward Virginia. Delaroche dialed Astrid at the Four Seasons and spoke to her as he pedaled steadily in Osborne's wake. Michael reached the Virginia side of the Potomac and headed south on the Mount Vernon Trail. His muscles were stiff and sore, and the cold December weather wasn't helping. But he quickened his pace and lengthened his stride. And after a few minutes of fast running, he felt sweat beneath his tracksuit. It was good to be free of the house. Carter had called earlier and informed Michael that Monica Tyler had formally ordered personnel to begin an investigation into his conduct. Elizabeth had finally acceded to her doctor's wishes and was working from home. Their bedroom had been turned into a law office, complete with Max Lewis. The clouds broke, and a warm winter's sun shone along the banks of the river. Michael passed the entrance to Roosevelt Island. A wooden footbridge stretched before him, running over several hundred yards of marsh and reed grass. Michael increased his pace, feet thumping on the crossboards of the bridge. It was a weekday, and he was alone on the trail. He played a game with himself, running an imaginary race. He broke into a sprint, driving his arms, lifting his knees. He rounded a corner, and the end of the bridge appeared, about 200 yards away. Michael forced himself to run still faster. His arms burned, his legs felt like dead weight, and his breath was raspy with the cold air and too many cigarettes. He reached the end of the footbridge, stumbled to a stop, and turned around to see the ground he had covered with his dash. Only then did he see the man pedaling toward him on a mountain bike. Chapter 44, Washington, D.C. Astrid Fogel telephoned downstairs and asked the valet to have the Range Rover waiting. She left the hotel room and took the elevator down to the lobby. She carried a handbag, and inside the bag was a silenced Beretta pistol. The Range Rover stood beneath the covered entrance of the hotel. Astrid gave the valet the claim ticket and a $5 bill. She climbed inside and drove off. Delaroche had kept her up half the night memorizing street maps. 5 minutes later, she was backing into a parking space a few blocks away on N Street. She shut down the engine, lit a cigarette, and waited for Delaroche to call. Michael stood bolt upright as adrenaline shot through his body. Suddenly, his arms and legs didn't ache any longer, and his breath came in short, quick bursts. He stared at the man approaching on the bicycle. A helmet covered the head, sunglasses the eyes. Michael stared at the exposed portion of his face. He had seen it before, in Colin Yardley's bedroom, on the Cairo airport video, on the Chelsea embankment. It was October. The assassin was reaching inside a nylon bag mounted on the handlebars of the bike. Michael knew he was reaching for his gun. If he turned and tried to run away, October would easily overtake and kill him. If he stood his ground, the result would be the same. He sprinted directly toward the oncoming bicycle. The move took the gunman by surprise. He was 20 yards away. The two men were approaching each other rapidly on a collision course. October frantically dug through the nylon bag, grabbing for the butt of the gun, trying to get his finger inside the trigger guard. He took hold of the gun, ripped it from the bag, and tried to levitate it at Michael. Michael arrived as the silenced Beretta emitted a dull thud. He lowered his shoulder and drove it into October's chest. The blow knocked October from the bike, and he landed on the wooden footbridge with a heavy thump. Michael managed to stay on his feet. He turned around and saw October lying on his back, still holding the gun. Michael had two options: rush October, try to disarm and capture him, or run away and get help. October was a ruthless assassin, trained in the martial arts. Michael had gone through rudimentary training at the farm, but he realized he would be no match for someone like October. Besides, he was holding one gun and probably had a second hidden somewhere on his body. Michael turned, ran a few yards along the footbridge, then leaped over the side into the mud and reed grass at the river's edge. He scrambled across a hillside slick with wet autumn leaves and disappeared into a stand of trees. Delaroche sat up and collected his bearings. The blow had knocked the breath from him, but he had escaped serious injury. He stuck the Beretta inside the waistband of his riding breeches and pulled his jersey over the butt. Two men with army sweatsuits rounded the corner as Delaroche was bending to pick up his bike. For an instant, he considered shooting them both. Then he realized the Pentagon was nearby, and the soldiers were simply out for a harmless midday run. "You all right?" one of them asked. "Just a ruffian who tried to rob me," Delaroche said, allowing his French accent to come through. "When I explained to the man that I had nothing of value, he knocked me from my bicycle." "Maybe you should see a doctor," the other said. "No, a bruise, perhaps, but nothing serious. I'll find the police officer and file a report.
Okay, be careful.
Thank you for stopping, gentlemen.
Delaroche waited for the soldiers to vanish from sight. He took hold of the bike by the handlebars and brought it upright. He was angry and excited. He had never blown an assassination, and he was angry with himself for not reacting better.
Osborne had proven himself a worthier opponent than Delaroche expected. His dash toward Delaroche demonstrated both bravery and cunning. His second decision, to escape rather than fight, also demonstrated intelligence, for Delaroche surely would have killed him. That was why Delaroche was excited. Most of his victims never knew what hit them. He appeared unexpectedly and killed without warning. Most of the time his work was less than challenging. Obviously, that would not be the case with Osborne. Delaroche had lost the element of surprise. Osborne was aware of his presence, and he would never allow Delaroche to get near him again. Delaroche would have to bring Osborne to him. Delaroche remembered the night on the Chelsea embankment. He remembered shooting the woman named Sarah Randolph 3 times in the face and hearing the anguished screams of Michael Osborne as he slipped away. A man who lost a woman in that manner would do almost anything to prevent it from happening again. He mounted the bicycle and pedaled north toward Key Bridge. He dialed Astrid's number. She answered on the first ring. Delaroche calmly told her what to do as he cycled over the bridge toward Georgetown. Michael reached the shoulder of the George Washington Parkway. At midday, there was little traffic. He crossed the parkway and ran up another hillside. The glass and steel office buildings of the Rosslyn section of Arlington stood before him. He found a public telephone outside a convenience store and rapidly dialed his own number. Max Lewis answered the phone.
Get me Elizabeth, now.
She came on the line a few seconds later.
Michael, what's wrong?
They're here, Elizabeth, Michael said, gasping for air. October just tried to kill me on the Mount Vernon Trail. Now listen very carefully and do exactly as I say. Chapter 45, Washington, D.C. Elizabeth rushed into Michael's study and threw open the closet door. The briefcase was on the top shelf, a brown rectangular box so ugly it could only have been created by the agency's Office of Technical Services. The shelf was beyond her reach, so she ripped Michael's chair away from his desk and rolled it into the closet. She stood on the chair and pulled down the briefcase. Max was in the bedroom. Elizabeth sat at the foot of the bed, pulled on a pair of brown suede cowboy boots, and then went to the closet and put on a thigh-length leather jacket. For some reason, she looked at her face in the mirror and ran a hand through her uncombed hair. Max looked at her.
Elizabeth, damn it, what the hell's going on?
Elizabeth forced herself to be calm.
I can't explain everything now, Max, but a man just tried to kill Michael while he was running.
Michael thinks that man is coming here, and he wants us to get out now.
Max looked at the briefcase.
What the hell is that?
It's called a gym, she said. I'll explain in a few minutes, but right now I need you to help me.
I'll do anything, Elizabeth, you know that.
Now listen to me carefully, Max, she said, taking his hand. We're going to walk out the front door very slowly, very calmly, and we're going to get in my car.
2 minutes after hanging up with Delaroche, Astrid Fogel saw the front door of the Osborne's house swing open and 2 figures emerge into the December sunlight. The first was Elizabeth Osborne. Astrid recognized her photograph from Delaroche's dossier. And the second was a white man of medium height and build. The woman carried a man's attaché case, the man nothing. They climbed into a silver E-Class Mercedes-Benz, the woman in the passenger seat, the man behind the wheel, and started the engine. Astrid considered what to do. Delaroche had told her to wait for him to return. Then they would enter the house and take the woman hostage. She couldn't allow the woman to escape. She decided to follow them and tell Delaroche where they were going. The Mercedes pulled away from the curb and entered the quiet street. Astrid started the engine of the Rover and followed them. She punched in Delaroche's number and quickly brought him up to date. "He's here!" Michael yelled into the phone.
"Who's here?" Adrian Carter said.
"October's here. He just tried to kill me on the Mount Vernon Trail."
"Are you sure?"
"Adrian, what kind of fucking question is that? Of course I'm sure."
"Where are you?"
"Roslyn.
Give me the address. I'll send a team to collect you."
Michael looked for a street sign and gave Carter his location.
"Where's Elizabeth?
I'll pick her up, too."
"She was at the house, but I told her to get out."
"Why the hell did you do that?"
"Because October and Astrid Fogel have been working as a pair throughout this thing. She's probably here, too. If I didn't get Elizabeth out of there, Fogel would have gone in and grabbed her. I'm sure of it."
"What's your plan?"
Michael told him.
"Jesus Christ! Who's the driver?"
"Her secretary. Kid named Max Lewis."
"God damn it, Michael! You know what October's going to do to that guy when he finds out?"
"Shut up, Adrian. Just hurry up and bring me in."
Elizabeth pulled down her sun visor and glanced into the vanity mirror as they headed south on Wisconsin Avenue. The black Range Rover was there, a woman behind the wheel, talking on a cellular telephone. Max said, "Who are we running from?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
At this point, I believe just about anything.
Her name is Astrid Fogel, and she's a terrorist from the Red Army faction."
"Jesus Christ."
"Make a left and drive normally." Max made a left onto M Street. At 31st Street, the light changed from green to yellow when he was 50 feet from the intersection. Elizabeth said, "Go through it." Max punched the accelerator. The Mercedes responded, dropping down a gear and gaining speed rapidly. They swept through the intersection to the angry blare of horns. Elizabeth glanced at the mirror and saw that the Range Rover was still there.
Shit.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Just keep driving."
At 28th Street, Max had no choice but to stop at a red light. The Range Rover pulled directly behind them. Elizabeth watched the woman in the vanity mirror, and Max did the same in the rearview mirror.
"Who do you think she's talking to?"
"She's talking to her partner."
"Is her partner Red Army faction, too?"
"No, he's a former KGB assassin, codenamed October."
The light turned green. Max pressed the accelerator so hard, the tires squealed on the pavement.
"Elizabeth, the next time you ask me to come to your house to work, I think I'll decline if that's all right with you."
"Shut up and drive, Max."
"Where?"
"Downtown."
Max headed east on L Street, the Range Rover shadowing them. Elizabeth toyed with the handle of the briefcase. She remembered Michael's words.
"Get out of the car, then throw the latch. Make sure the case is right side up. Walk calmly away. Whatever you do, don't run."
The traffic thickened as they moved deeper into downtown Washington.
"You sure that thing is going to work?" Max asked.
"How the hell should I know?"
"Maybe it's been in the closet too long. See if it has an expiration date on it or something."
Elizabeth looked at him and saw he was smiling.
"It's going to be all right, Elizabeth. Don't worry."
He turned right on Connecticut Avenue. The midday traffic was heavy. Cars rushing at high speed along the broad street. Big trucks double parked outside the exclusive shops. A half dozen cars had slipped between them and Astrid Fogel.
Elizabeth said, "I think this is our spot. Make the right onto K Street. Use the service lane."
"Got it."
He punched the accelerator and turned the wheel hard to the right.
Astrid said to Delaroche, "They just made a right on K Street. Damn it, I can't see them."
She made the turn and spotted the Mercedes slipping from the service lane into the heavy traffic on K Street.
"I have them. They're heading west on K Street."
"Where are you?"
23rd Street, heading south. "We're very close."
Astrid followed the Mercedes westward, across 20th Street, and then 21st Street. I'm getting close, Jean-Paul. Where are you?
M Street. Wait for me at 23rd.
She crossed 23rd Street and stopped on the northwest corner. The Mercedes drew away. She looked north on 23rd Street and saw Delaroche pedaling at high speed, legs churning like pistons. He stopped, leaned the bike against the lamppost, and climbed into the Range Rover.
Go!
Elizabeth settled into the back of a taxi for the ride to the Hertz rental car outlet. Michael's gadget had worked just the way he said it would. Max stopped the car. Elizabeth climbed out and pulled the latch. A figure rapidly inflated, amazingly lifelike. Max drove quickly away, and Elizabeth walked into the lobby of her building. She was tempted to walk upstairs and hide in her office, but she remembered the janitor and the expensive haircut and special forces ring, and knew her office was no longer safe. She waited behind the glass until the Range Rover sped past, and then she stepped out and flagged down the taxi. The taxi dropped her outside the Hertz outlet. She walked quickly inside and went to the rental counter. 5 minutes later, an attendant brought a gray Mercury Sable to the front of the garage. Elizabeth climbed in and pulled out into the downtown traffic. She drove west across Washington through Georgetown, then onto Reservoir Road. She took Reservoir down to Canal Road and followed it north along the banks of the C&O Canal. After 10 miles, she came to the Beltway. She followed the signs north to Baltimore. Her purse rested next to her on the passenger seat. She pulled out her cell phone and dialed the Mercedes. After 5 rings, a recorded voice informed her that the cellular phone she was trying to reach was not in service at this time. Max Lewis drove across Key Bridge and turned north onto the George Washington Parkway. He had lost the Range Rover somewhere in Georgetown. He looked across at the figure seated next to him, a tall, rather attractive man with dark hair and a clean shave. He realized the figure looked something like Michael Osborne. He glanced up into the rearview mirror. Still no sign of the Range Rover. For a mad instant, he was actually enjoying himself. Then he thought of Elizabeth and how frightened she had been, and he regained a healthy dose of nerves. Elizabeth had told him to drive straight to the main entrance of the CIA. Someone would meet him there and take him inside. He pressed down on the accelerator, and the speedometer needle jumped to 75. The Mercedes flowed easily over the rolling hills and gentle turns of the parkway. The Potomac sparkled below in the brilliant December sunlight. Max looked at the mannequin again. "Listen, Mr. Jib, since we're going to be spending some time together, I think now would be a good opportunity to get to know more about each other. My name is Max, and yes, I'm gay. I hope that doesn't bother you." He looked into the rearview mirror and saw the flashing blue light of a Virginia State Trooper. He looked at the speedometer and saw he was driving nearly 80 miles per hour. "Oh, shit," Max said, gently pressing the brake and pulling into a scenic river overlook. The trooper climbed out of the car and put on his hat. Max lowered the window. The trooper said, "You were driving well over 70 back there, sir, and probably closer to 80. May I see your driver's license, please?" Then he noticed the inflatable figure on the passenger seat. "What's that, sir?" "It's a very long story, officer." "Your driver's license, please." Max beat the breast pockets of his coat. He had rushed out of the Osborne's house so quickly he had forgotten his briefcase and his wallet. He said, "I'm sorry, officer, but I don't have my license on me." "Shut off the engine and step out of the car, please," the officer said in a dull monotone. But at that moment, he was distracted by the sight of a black Range Rover pulling into the overlook. Max said, "Officer, you're going to think I'm nuts, but you'd better listen to what I have to say." Delaroche climbed out of the Range Rover and walked toward the trooper. Astrid got out and stepped to the front of the Mercedes. The trooper unsnapped his holster and was reaching for his weapon. "Get back in the car, sir, now." Delaroche reached beneath his cycling jersey and took hold of the silenced Beretta. His arm swung up and he fired twice. The first shot struck the officer in the shoulder, spinning him around. The second struck him in the back of the head, and he collapsed under the shoulder of the road. Astrid stood in front of the Mercedes, gun in outstretched hands. She looked first at the man behind the wheel, then at the mannequin sitting where Elizabeth Osborne had been. She was overcome with rage. She had been taken in by one of the oldest tricks in the book. The engine started, and the Mercedes dropped into gear. Astrid calmly fired 3 shots through the windshield. The glass shattered and was instantly red with blood. The body collapsed forward under the steering column, and the afternoon was filled with the blaring of the car's horn. Michael maintained a tense vigil in Adrian Carter's office, pacing and smoking cigarettes. Carter putted golf balls to relieve his nerves. One of Monica Tyler's fat totems waited outside Carter's office like a schoolboy in detention. Michael closed the door so they could talk. Why was I never allowed to see the file on October? Because it was restricted, Carter said tonelessly, head bowed in concentration. He stroked the ball, but missed the target by 6 inches. Shit, Carter murmured. Pushed it. Why was it restricted? This is an intelligence agency, Michael, not a Christian Science reading room. During the time October was an active KGB agent, you probably had no need to know of his existence. Carter stroked another putt. This one landed on the mark. Michael said, why was the information on October so tightly held? To protect the identity of the source, I assume. That's usually the case. Damn it! He killed Sarah Randolph right in front of me. Why couldn't someone in this fucking place just show me the file at some point and help me put it to rest? Because that would have been the sensible thing to do. But sensibility and intelligence work rarely go hand in hand. Surely you've learned that by now. How did you get it? We had some evidence a couple of years ago that October was working again on a freelance basis, Carter said. The file was dusted off and put back into circulation on a very limited basis. Were you allowed to see it? Carter nodded. Damn it, Adrian. While I was trying to piece Sarah's murder together with half clues and conjecture, you had the answer all the time. Why didn't you tell me? Carter pulled a face that said sometimes intelligence work required lying to one's friends. These are the rules by which we live, Michael. They protect the people who risk their lives by betraying their own country. They protect people like you who work undercover in the field. So why did you break the rules now and give me October's file? Because in this case, the rules sucked. It made no sense. Who wanted October's file to remain restricted? Carter jerked a thumb at the factotum outside his door and whispered, Monica Tyler. Elizabeth finally telephoned, and the emergency switchboard put the call through to Carter's office. What happened? Are you all right? I'm fine, she said. I did everything you told me. That suitcase of yours worked perfectly. It even looked a little like you. I'm in the car now. I'm going where you told me to go. Osborne smiled in utter relief. Thank God, he said. Have you heard from Max yet? No, not yet. He should be here any minute. Carter's secretary poked her head in the door and said there was another call. Carter took it on an extension outside. Osborne said, Elizabeth, I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. I love you too, Michael. Is this nightmare over yet? Not quite, but soon. Keep driving. We'll figure out how and when to bring you in. I love you, Michael, she said, and the connection was broken. Carter came into the office, face ashen. Michael said, what's wrong? Max Lewis and a Virginia State trooper were just shot to death on the George Washington Parkway. Michael slammed down the telephone. Chapter 46, Washington, D.C. Villaroche crossed Key Bridge and headed back into Georgetown. He drove quickly along M Street and pulled into the drive of the Four Seasons Hotel. He waited outside in the rover while Astrid went to get their things from the room. It gave him a moment to collect his thoughts and plan their next move. The easiest thing to do was abort. Call for an extraction and get out of the country before they were captured. Delaroche felt confident the shootings on the parkway had gone unwitnessed. The killings took seconds, and they were gone before another car passed the scene. But he had tried once to kill Michael Osborne, and Osborne obviously knew he was here. The stunt his wife pulled with the inflatable dummy was proof of that. Fulfilling the terms of his contract, killing Osborne would be very difficult now. Delaroche wanted to continue, though, for two reasons. One was money. If he failed to kill Osborne, he would forfeit $750,000. Delaroche wanted to live out his days with Astrid free from financial and security concerns. That would require a great deal of money. Money to buy a large house with property and sophisticated surveillance systems. Money to bribe local law enforcement officials so he could remain hidden from the security services of the West. He also wanted to live a comfortable existence. He had lived like a monk in Brele for years, unable to spend his money for fear of attracting attention. It had been even worse when he was with the KGB. Arbatov had made him live like a pauper in Paris on the little bit of money he earned from his paintings. The second reason, indeed the important reason, was pride. Osborne had beaten him on the footpath along the river, outsmarted Delaroche at his own game. He had never blown an assignment, and he didn't want to end his career with a failure. Killing was his job. He had been born and bred to do it, and failure was unacceptable. Osborne was the first target to fight back successfully, and Delaroche had bungled the hit. He had reacted like an amateur on his first job. He was embarrassed and angry with himself, and he wanted another chance. He thought of Osborne's dossier. He recalled that Elizabeth Osborne's father, a United States senator, had a home on a secluded island in New York. He thought, if I were scared, I would go somewhere I felt safe, somewhere far away, somewhere the authorities could provide the illusion of security. I would leave Washington as quickly as possible and go to a secluded island. Astrid came out of the hotel. Delaroche started the engine as she climbed in. He left the hotel and parked beneath an elevated freeway along the river's edge. Then he shut down the engine and switched on his laptop computer. He scrolled through his files until he found the Osborne dossier. He read it quickly and found the location of the senator's house. Yes, he thought. Even the name was perfect. They'll go there because they'll believe it's safe. He exited the dossier and clicked on his database, where he had stored digital roadmaps of nearly every nation on the planet. He typed in his starting point and his destination, and the software quickly provided him with a route. The Beltway, I-95, the Verrazano Bridge, the Long Island Expressway. He started the engine again and dropped the Range Rover into gear. Astrid said, "Where are we going, Jean-Paul?" He tapped the screen of the laptop. She looked down and read, "Shelter Island." He picked up the cellular phone, dialed the number given to him by the contractors, and spoke quietly into the mouthpiece as he drove out of Washington. The helicopter touched down at the Atlantic City airport. Elizabeth had taken I-95 north, then cut across to the Jersey Shore. Airport security officers were waiting when she pulled into the Hertz rental car return area. They took her into protective custody and kept her in a small holding room inside the terminal for 10 minutes. When the helicopter's rotor had safely stopped, Elizabeth was taken in an airport van from the holding room to the tarmac. A heavy rain was falling. The last thing she wanted to do on a night like this was fly in a helicopter. But she wanted to be home. She wanted to feel safe. She wanted to smell familiar bedding, see cherished things from her childhood. For a while, she wanted to pretend that none of it had ever happened. The van door opened, and a blast of cold rain beat against her face. She climbed out and walked toward the helicopter. The door opened, and Michael stood there. She ran into his arms and held him tightly. She kissed him and said, "I'm never going to let you out of my sight again." Michael said nothing, just held her. Finally, she asked, "Where's Max?" "Somewhere safe, I hope." He held her more tightly. She read something in his silence and pulled away, staring wide-eyed. "Damn it, Michael, answer me. Where's Max?" But she knew the answer. He didn't have to say the words. "God, no!" she screamed and beat her fists against his chest. "Not again! God, no, not again!" "It seems our man made quite a mess of things in Washington," the director said. "He failed to kill Osborne, and in the process, he managed to kill a secretary and a Virginia state trooper," Mitchell Elliott said. "Perhaps his reputation as the world's finest assassin was undeserved. Osborne is a very worthy opponent. We always knew eliminating him would be difficult." "Where's our man now?" "On his way north. He believes Osborne and his wife will seek safety at Senator Cannon's home on Shelter Island." "Well, he's correct." "Your source inside Langley confirms this?" "Yes." "Very well. So this unfortunate business will all be over soon. October will finish what he started. I have an extraction team on standby. When he's finished, he'll contact me, and I'll pull him out." "October had one other target in Washington." "Yes, I realize that. But he's quite incapable of carrying out that job now. If you want that target eliminated, I suppose we'll have to hire someone else to do the job." "I think it would be wise. I don't like loose ends." "I quite agree." "And October?" "A few minutes after his extraction, October will be killed. You see, Mr. Elliott, I dislike loose ends more than you do." "Very well, Director. Good evening, Mr. Elliott." Mitchell Elliott hung up the telephone and smiled at Monica Tyler. She carried her drink to bed and lay down beside him. "It will all be over by morning," he said. "Osborne will be gone, and you'll be rich beyond your wildest imagination." She kissed him. "I'll be rich, Mitchell. But will I be alive to enjoy it?" Elliot shut out the light. "I'm glad my father's not here to see this," Elizabeth said as the helicopter set down on the lawn of Cannon Point. "He always tries to act like one of the islanders when he's out here. The last thing he would ever do is land a helicopter on his lawn." "It's the dead of winter," Michael said. "No one will ever know." Elizabeth looked at him incredulously. "Michael, every time someone hits a deer on this island, it gets written up in the local newspaper. Believe me, people will know." Adrian Carter said, "I'll take care of the newspaper." The helicopter's rotors stopped turning. The door opened, and the three of them climbed out. Charlie came out of the caretaker's cottage, flashlight in hand, retrievers scrambling at his ankles. Sea wind tore at the leafless trees. An osprey screamed and broke into flight over their heads. 50 yards from shore, the Athena clung to her mooring in the wind-tossed waters of the bay. "Where's the senator?" Carter asked as they walked the gravel drive toward the main house. "In London," Michael said. "He's taking part in a panel discussion on Northern Ireland at the London School of Economics." "Good. One less person to worry about." "I don't want to turn this place into an armed camp," Elizabeth said. "I don't intend to. I'll have 2 security officers on the lawn all night. They'll be relieved in the morning by 2 more from New York Station. Shelter Island police have agreed to watch the North and the South ferries. They have a good description of October and Astrid Fogel. They've been told they're wanted in connection with the murder of 2 people in Virginia, but nothing more."
"Let's keep it that way," Elizabeth said. "The last thing I want is for the people of Shelter Island to think we've brought terrorists to this place."
"The truth won't come out," Carter said. Go inside. Get some sleep. Call me at Langley in the morning, Michael. And don't worry. October is long gone by now. Carter shook Michael's hand and kissed Elizabeth's cheek. I'm so sorry about Max, he said. I wish there was something we could have done. I know, Indian. Elizabeth turned and walked toward the house. Carter looked at Michael and said, Any weapons in there? Michael shook his head. Cannon hates guns. Carter handed Michael a high-powered Browning automatic and a half-dozen 15-shot magazines. Then he turned and climbed aboard the helicopter. 30 seconds later, it lifted off Cannon Point, turned, and disappeared over the bay. Carter gave you a gun, didn't he? Elizabeth said as Michael entered the bedroom. She was standing before an open armoire, choosing a flannel nightgown. The room was dark except for a small reading lamp burning on a bedside table. Michael displayed the Browning. He snapped a magazine into the butt and clicked the safety. God, I hate that sound, she said, undressing. She slipped on the nightgown and lay down on the bed. Michael was standing at the window, smoking a cigarette, watching the bay. Rain dashed against the glass. One of the security men was inspecting the bulkhead along the point by flashlight. Elizabeth placed her hands on her lower abdomen. She wondered if the babies were all right. She thought, listen to you, Elizabeth. Already calling them babies, when they're nothing more than a cluster of cells. Her doctor had told her to take it easy, to stay off her feet. She had hardly done that. She had spent the day on the run from a pair of terrorists, driving for hours and flying on a helicopter through a buffeting storm. She pressed her hands tighter to her abdomen and thought, Please, God, let them be well. She looked at Michael, standing straight as a sentinel in the window. You know, Michael, I think you actually want him to try again. After what he did to Max. He tried to kill you today, too, Michael. Believe me, I haven't forgotten. And Sarah? She said. He was silent. It's healthy to want revenge, Michael. But trying to get revenge is something altogether different. It's a dangerous thing. People get hurt. And in this case, they could get killed. For all our sakes, I hope he's far away. It's not in his makeup. It's not in his training. What's not? To give up? To run away? I've read his file. I probably know more about him than he knows about himself. You think he's out there, Michael? I know he's out there. I just don't know where. Chapter 47, North Haven, Long Island. Delaroche climbed out of the Range Rover and steered across the narrow channel toward Shelter Island. It was nearly midnight. It had taken 8 hours to make the drive from Washington because Delaroche had meticulously kept to the speed limit the entire way. He turned up the collar of his coat against the cold, wind-blown rain. A ferry plowed toward him, two cars on the deck, beating against the heavy current rushing through Shelter Island Sound toward the open water of Gardiner's Bay. Outside the small ferry office was a tan four-wheel drive vehicle with police markings. It was possible the officer was just making rounds or had stopped for a cup of coffee. Delaroche doubted that was the case, though. He suspected the police were watching the ferry because Michael and Elizabeth Osborne were on the island. He walked back to the Range Rover, climbed inside, and drove away from the ferry landing. Twice he had to swerve to avoid small herds of white-tailed deer. He turned onto a small dirt and gravel road that ran into a stand of trees. There, hidden from view, he slipped on his reading glasses and unfolded a large-scale Long Island road map that he purchased at a gas station along the way. Astrid peered over his shoulder. North Haven was a small thumb of land jutting into Shelter Island Sound. To the southeast lay the historic whaling port of Sag Harbor. The police are watching the ferry landings, Delaroche said. That means the Osbournes are probably on the island. The South Ferry shuts down at 1 a.m. The police will go home because they'll conclude we haven't tried to make the crossing. If the ferries are shut down, how do we get onto the island? Delaroche tapped the map at Sag Harbor. There will be boats in the harbor and on the docks. We can steal one and make the crossing after the ferries stop running. Astrid said, "The weather is terrible. It's not safe to go out in a boat on a night like this." "This isn't so bad," Delaroche said, removing his eyeglasses and slipping them back into his pocket. "In Brele, they would consider this a fine night for fishing." Delaroche entered Sag Harbor and parked along the marina. He climbed out of the Range Rover, leaving Astrid behind. The town was quiet, the shops and restaurants along the waterfront closed. After 5 minutes, Delaroche found what he was looking for, a 26-foot Boston whaler with a large Johnson outboard motor. He walked quickly back to the Range Rover and collected the things he needed, the cellular phones, the Berettas, the waterproof clothing. He locked the doors and pocketed the keys. They walked along the marina and along a wooden dock, slick with rain. Delaroche climbed into the whaler and helped Astrid onto the deck. There was a standing bridge and seating compartments forward and aft. Delaroche worked a lockpick inside the ignition and started the engine. He leaped onto the dock and untied the line, then jumped in the boat again and backed out of the slip. He cruised slowly through the harbor, boat throbbing beneath his feet. 20 minutes later, they entered the waters of Gardiner's Bay. 5 minutes into the journey, Delaroche feared Astrid had been right. On the bay, the wind was ferocious, beating down from the northwest at 40 miles per hour with stronger gusts. The temperature was 40 degrees, but the rain and wind made it feel much colder. The cockpit of the whaler was open, and within minutes, Delaroche and Astrid were soaked. Delaroche's hands were frozen to the wheel, despite his gloves. Astrid clung to his arm and buried her face in his shoulder against the rain. The night was pitch black. No moon, no starlight, nothing by which to navigate. Delaroche kept his own running lights doused to avoid being spotted from shore. Swells of 4 to 5 feet beat against the port side of the whaler, tossing the shallow draft little boat about. Delaroche moved to within 200 yards of the shoreline and headed due north. The seas calmed slightly. Off the port side, he could see the very faint outline of trees and land. Delaroche knew from his maps that it was Mashemak Preserve, a giant nature conservancy. He continued north, past Sachem's Neck and Gibson's Beach. He nearly ran aground at Nichols Point, so he turned a few degrees to stern and moved farther offshore. After a few minutes, he spotted Real Point, a thin finger of land at the mouth of Creakle's Harbor. He knew he was getting closer. They rounded Ram Head and set the whaler on a northwest heading toward Cornelius Point. The course change placed them directly into the path of the wind. Their speed slowed to a walking pace as the rollers grew larger. The little boat rose skyward as each wave passed beneath the hull. Then the prow would slam down into the next trough, and seawater would crash into the seating compartments. Once Astrid lost her grip and fell forward onto the dash. She regained her footing and stood up, blood on her forehead. Delaroche could make out Cornelius Point off the port side, a rocky headland, the faint outline of a large summer cottage. He rounded the point and turned a few degrees to port. Off the starboard side, he could see the lights of Greenport, blurry with sea fog and rain. A few moments later, he passed Hay Beach Point. Delaroche turned to the southwest and ran along Hay Beach for about a quarter mile. Then he turned sharply to port and reduced power, running toward the shoreline. Cannon Point was about 400 yards farther down. Delaroche knew he could approach the shoreline in virtual silence because the high winds would carry all sound in the opposite direction. He killed the engine and raised the propeller. A few seconds later, the boat grounded itself on a shoal a few yards from the beach. Dolorosh leaped into the icy, knee-deep water and waded ashore. He pulled back the sleeve of his jacket and glanced at the luminous face of his watch. It was just 2 o'clock. The whaler had made the journey from Sag Harbor in about 90 minutes. But as Dolorosh tied the bowline to the limb of a fallen tree, he felt as though he had been behind the wheel fighting the sea for half the night. He waded back to the whaler, collected the backpack, and helped Astrid over the side into the water. On the beach, he unzipped the backpack, dug out the silenced Berettas, and gave one to her. The rain beat down on them as Dolorosh took his bearings. The beach ran directly to Cannon Point. It was rocky and narrow, only a few feet wide in spots. Beyond the high water mark rose a sheer bluff about 20 feet high, tangled with brush and dune grass. Dolorosh pulled the slider on the Beretta, chambering the first round. Astrid did the same. Then he took her by the hand and led her down the beach toward the house. Matt Cooper and Scott Jacobs had both worked in CIA security for nearly 20 years. Their government sedan was parked just inside the main gate of the compound on Shore Road. They took turns walking the perimeter of the grounds every half hour. Matt Cooper handled the 2 a.m. round. Dolorosh and Astrid lay on the bluff, overlooking the water, hidden behind the thick, thorny brush. Dolorosh took in the layout of the compound. The large main house, close to the water, 2 guest cottages, a separate 3-car garage. Lights burned in the main house and in one of the cottages. Dolorosh assumed that the Osbournes were in the main house, and the security detail, or a caretaker, was in the cottage. He studied the layout of the grounds. A flat, well-tended lawn, dotted with tall trees. A gravel drive leading from the buildings to the front gate. Just inside the gate, Dolorosh glimpsed the outline of a sedan. The security man appeared a few minutes later. He carried a powerful flashlight in his right hand and played it across the grounds as he walked. As the man approached their position, Dolorosh took Astrid firmly by the upper arm and held a finger to his lips. She nodded. A shaft of light shone over their heads, then played across the bulkhead and the beach below. Dolorosh stood suddenly, battling brush. The beam of light played frantically for several seconds before it settled on him. His Beretta was drawn and leveled. Using the light as a target, Dolorosh adjusted his aim to the right an inch or two in order to compensate for the fact that the security man held the light in his right hand. He fired rapidly 3 times. The security man collapsed onto the sodden turf. Dolorosh crept forward and knelt beside the fallen man. The shots had struck his chest. Dolorosh reached down, felt the neck for a pulse, and found none. He gestured for Astrid to join him. They walked along the eastern edge of the property, keeping to the trees, until they were about 30 yards from the front gate and the security car. Dolorosh could see the second man inside the car, sitting behind the wheel, rainwater streaming down the windows. Certainly the man could see very little. It would be an easy kill. The challenge would be killing him silently. He crossed the lawn, passing behind the car, and approached from the rear passenger side. Cooper had been too long in checking in. Usually, each man gave continuous updates of his progress by radio. Cooper had checked in from the west guest cottage and from the back of the main house. But Jacobs had not heard from him since he started toward the bulkhead in the beach. Jacobs snatched up his radio and tried to raise Cooper, but there was no response. He was about to get out and go look for him when he heard the passenger door open. He turned and said, "What the hell happened to you?" Then he looked at the face. Short cropped hair, very pale skin, 2 pierced ears. Jacobs didn't even attempt to go for his gun. Just said softly, "Oh, Jesus Christ." Dolorosh raised his Beretta and shot him 3 times in the face. Then he reached across the seat and took the radio from the dead man's hand. Astrid stayed in the trees. Delaroche climbed out of the car and softly closed the door. They retraced their route along the eastern boundary of the property, keeping to the trees once more. Delaroche ejected his half-spent ammunition clip and inserted a full one. There were two entrances to the main house, a front door overlooking the gravel drive and a large screened porch overlooking the water. Delaroche planned to use the rear entrance. The trees twisted in a gust of sea wind. Delaroche used the loud rushing noise to cover the sound of their approach. He took Astrid's hand and hurried through the treacherous ground between the trees. They passed behind the cottage, where a porch light burned. Delaroche considered entering the cottage and killing the occupants, but there had been no activity on the grounds, no sign that their presence had been noticed, so he passed behind the cottage and started across the rear lawn. A dog barked, then another. He turned and saw a pair of large golden retrievers running toward them. He chambered the first round in his Beretta and raised the gun at the advancing dogs. The dogs awakened Michael. His eyes opened wide, and he was suddenly alert. He heard the first dog, then the second. Then both fell silent. He sat up in bed and swung his feet to the floor. On his bedside table were the Browning automatic, a portable radio, and a multiple-line telephone. He snatched up the radio and said, "This is Osborne. Anyone there?" Elizabeth stirred. "This is Osborne. Is anyone there? I heard dogs barking." The radio crackled and the voice said, "The dogs are fine, sir. No problem." Osborne set down the radio, picked up the telephone, and dialed the number in the caretaker's cottage. He let the phone ring 5 times before slamming the receiver back into place. Elizabeth sat up in bed. Osborne quickly dialed a special emergency number at Langley. A calm voice answered. "This is Osborne. Shelter Island security detail is off the air. Call the local police and get some more men out here now. Move it." He hung up the phone. Elizabeth said, "Michael, what's wrong?" "He's here," Osborne said. "He's killed the security team, and he's got their radio. I just spoke to the bastard. Get some warm clothes on. Hurry, Elizabeth." Charlie Gibbons had been the caretaker at Cannon Point for 20 years. He was born and raised on Shelter Island and could trace his ancestry to the whalers who worked from Greenport 3 centuries earlier. He lived only 90 miles from New York City, but had been there just once. Charlie could hear the telephone ringing in his cottage as he walked across the lawn in his bathrobe, shotgun in one hand, flashlight in the other. He spotted the dogs a moment later and ran clumsily toward them. He knelt beside the first and saw his yellow coat was soaked with blood. He turned the beam of his flashlight on the second and saw it was in the same condition. He rose and shone his flashlight toward the bulkhead. He played the beam back and forth for a few seconds and spotted something bright blue. The security men had been wearing blue waterproof jackets. He ran toward the fallen figure and knelt beside him. It was a man named Matt Cooper, and he was clearly dead. He had to wake Michael and Elizabeth. He had to telephone the Shelter Island police. He had to get help quickly. He got to his feet and turned to run back to the cottage. A tall, blonde woman stepped from behind a tree, a gun in outstretched hands. He saw the muzzle flash, but heard no sound. The rounds tore through his chest. He felt an excruciating pain, saw a flash of brilliant white light, then darkness. Chapter 48. McLean, Virginia. "The security team is off the air," the duty officer said. "Osborne believes October is on the premises." Adrian Carter sat up in bed. "God damn it! We've alerted local police and another detail is en route. They'd better fucking hurry." "Yes, sir." "I'll be at headquarters in 5 minutes." "Yes, sir." "Now connect me with Monica Tyler." "Stand by, sir." Michael had slept with his clothes on. Elizabeth pulled on a pair of gray cotton sweatpants and a beige woolen sweater. Michael slipped on his shoes and collected the Browning, the radio, and cellular phone, and the keypad for the home's security system. The system was activated. The alarm would sound if October tried to enter the house. A number would read out on the keypad's digital display, showing which door or window the intruder had breached. If October tried to break inside the house, Michael would instantly know where he was. Michael shut off the bedroom lights and led Elizabeth into the darkened hallway. They followed the stairs down to the entrance hall. Another light burned there. Michael quickly killed it. The stairway to the basement was just off the large kitchen. Michael took Elizabeth's arm and led her through the darkness. He opened the doorway to the stairs and led her down to the basement. Villaroche and Astrid crouched next to the door of the screened porch. Villaroche worked a knife inside the crude latch. It gave way after a few seconds. They picked their way across the veranda, around overstuffed rattan furniture and low tables, to a set of French doors. He tried the latch. It was locked. He crouched and worked his lockpick in the keyhole. The lock mechanism snapped. Villaroche pushed back the doors, and he slipped inside. The house, in fact, had three entrances. The main front doorway, the rear sun porch, and a small basement doorway on the north side of the house, hidden behind a set of recessed steps. Michael and Elizabeth moved through the finished rooms of the basement until they reached the doorway. The alarm sounded in his hand. Michael quickly killed the tone and reset it. October had entered the house through the French doors off the living room. A few seconds later, the alarm sounded again, then a third time. Two motion detectors had been triggered, one in the dining room, one in the living room. The detectors were several feet apart. Unless October was moving through the house very rapidly, it was unlikely that he set off both. The house was dark and unfamiliar to him. Michael assumed Astrid Fogel was in the house, too. He turned to Elizabeth and said, "Go to the guest cottage and wait there until the police come." "Michael, I don't want to leave you in..." "Just do it, Elizabeth," Michael snapped. "If you want to live, just do what I say." She nodded. "The police will be here in a few minutes. When you see them, run for them. It's me he wants, not you. Do you understand me?" She nodded. Michael said, "Good." He punched in the disarm code and opened the door. Elizabeth kissed his cheek and started up the stairs. At the top, she paused and looked in all directions. The night was pitch black. She could barely make out the faint outline of the guest cottage overlooking the water. She ran across the lawn, wind-blown rain beating against her face, until she reached the door of the cottage. She opened the door, stepped inside, then turned and took one last look at Michael. The basement door closed, and he was gone. She closed the door and locked it, leaving the lights on. Then she went to the window and looked in the direction of the front gate. There was Astrid Fogel standing in the living room, who spotted something moving across the lawn toward the guest cottage. A light-colored sweater. A woman, judging by the slightly awkward stride. "Jean-Paul," she whispered, and gestured toward the lawn. "The woman." "Take her," Villaroche whispered. Then he laid a hand on her arm and said, "Alive, Astrid. She's no good to us dead. And hurry, we don't have much time." Astrid slipped out the French doors, crossed the veranda, and set off across the lawn. Michael reset the alarm system. He found a rechargeable flashlight plugged into an outlet. The senator had flashlights positioned throughout the house because of the island's frequent power outages. Michael switched on the light and played the beam back and forth across the walls until he found the fuse box. He opened it and shone the light inside. The master switch was the largest. He threw the switch and killed power to the entire house. The alarm system ran on batteries, so it would remain functional. He set the alarm on silent. He followed the beam of light up the stairs and returned to the kitchen. On the wall next to the telephone was an intercom box for the front gate. The intercom operated on the telephone system, and the gate had a separate power source. He pressed a button and went quickly to a living room window overlooking the lawn. Outside, at the head of the property, he could see the metal gate rolling open on its track. The guest cottage felt like an ice house. Elizabeth couldn't remember the last time someone had stayed in the place. The thermostat was set to the lowest level to keep the pipes from bursting in a hard freeze. The wind tore at the shingled roof and beat against the windows overlooking Shelter Island Sound. Something scratched against the side of the house. Elizabeth emitted a short scream, then realized it was only the old oak tree that she had climbed countless times as a child. It wasn't the guest cottage. In the lexicon of the Cannon family, it was known as Elizabeth's cottage. The place was comfortable and modestly furnished. There were light-finished hardwood floors, and in the living room, rustic furniture arranged around the large picture window overlooking the harbor. The kitchen was tiny, just a small refrigerator and a stove with two burners, the bedroom simple. When she was a child, the cottage had been hers. When the main house was filled with her father's staff or some delegation from a strange country, Elizabeth would come here to hide among her possessions. She adored the cottage, cared for it, spent summer nights in it. She smoked her first dope in the bathroom and lost her virginity in the bedroom. She thought, if I could choose a place to die, it would be here. She blew on her hands and wrapped her arms tightly around herself against the cold. Reflexively, she touched her lower abdomen. She again thought, are the babies all right? God, let them be all right. She went to the window and looked out. A tall woman was running toward the cottage, gun in hand. She could see enough of the face to realize it was the same woman who had pursued her in Washington. She walked backward from the window and nearly toppled over an armchair. It's me he wants, not you. She knew Michael was lying to her. They would use her to get to Michael, but they would kill her too, just the way they killed Max, just the way they killed Susanna. She heard the scrape of boots on the wooden steps to the front door. She heard the metallic clicking of Astrid Fogel trying the doorknob. She heard a loud thud as Astrid Fogel tried to kick the door down, and she summoned every ounce of self-control she had to keep from screaming. She moved to the bedroom and closed the door. She heard a series of low thuds, three or four, she couldn't be certain, and the sound of splintering wood. Astrid Fogel shooting her way through the lock. Another kick, and this time the door crashed open, slamming into the adjoining wall. It's me he wants, not you. And you're a liar, Michael Osborne, she thought. They were merciless and sadistic. There would be no reasoning with them, and certainly no negotiating. She backpedaled into the corner, eyes on the closed door. God, how many times had she been here before? On beautiful summer mornings, on chilly autumn afternoons. The books on the shelves were hers, and so were the clothes in the closet. Even the threadbare rug at the foot of the bed. She thought of the afternoon she and her mother bought it together at an auction in Bridgehampton. She thought, I can't let her take me. They'll kill us both. She heard the woman walking through the cottage, the footfalls of her boots on the hardwood floors. She heard the wind rushing through the trees, the screaming of gulls. She stepped forward and put the hook on the door. Hide in the closet, she thought. Maybe she won't look. Don't be silly, Elizabeth. Think. Then she heard the woman call out, I know you're in here, Mrs. Osborne. I don't want to hurt you. Just come out now. The voice was low and strangely pleasant, the accent German. Don't listen to her. She opened the closet door and slipped inside. She closed the door halfway. She couldn't bear the thought of being sealed in the tiny dark room. Finally, she heard the wail of sirens, far off, carried by the wind. She wondered where they were. Winthrop Road, Manhasset Road, if they were coming from Mid-Island. Either way, Elizabeth knew she would be dead before they arrived. She backed away from the door. Something sharp dug into her shoulder blade. An arrow, sitting on the shelf. She groped along the wall. She knew it was here somewhere. The bow her father had given her when she turned 12. It was hanging from a hook on the wall, next to an ancient set of golf clubs. The woman tried the bedroom door and discovered it was locked. Elizabeth thought, now she knows I'm in here. Panic shot through her. She forced herself to breathe. Softly, she beat her palms along the wall until she touched something cold and hard. Elizabeth took down the bow. It was 5.5 feet long, standard length. She reached up and grabbed hold of the arrow. The shaft was aluminum with feather fletchings. She took the arrow between the first two fingers on her right hand and with her thumb felt for the string notch behind the fletchings. She had done this countless times, so doing it in the dark was not a problem, even with shaking hands. The woman kicked the door, but the old hook held. Elizabeth fixed the arrow to the string and braced the shaft against the fingers of her left hand, which was clutching the bow. She pulled the arrow back halfway, then took a deep breath. The bowstring was old and brittle. It might simply snap when she pulled it to the tension required to shoot an arrow. Please, Elizabeth thought, fingering the string, I need one more shot from you. But could she really do this? She had never killed a living thing, never dreamed of hunting. Her father wouldn't hear of it in any case. Once he caught one of her boyfriends stalking a deer with her bow and arrow and banished him from the house for the rest of the summer. End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.